Eastern, you get to hear one of the best shows of the week on the Maria Helles Show right here on PRN.FM. If you missed the show, they're archived right here on site at PRN. Support Real Truth in Media by tuning in and sharing the information you hear with anyone that'll listen. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, I'm Gary Null, and I'm happy to be just one of the many voices speaking truth to power every day on the Progressive Radio Network. We have dozens and dozens of the finest minds in the United States, people who have spent their careers helping, first and foremost, bring justice to issues. Ralph Nader, Jimmy Dore, Gerald Salante, Utrice Lee. From all communities, we look at what is the truth. We are not right. We are not left. We're not card-carrying members of any party. We may have been at one time, but today we're just looking to how we can cut through all of the nonsense. Occam's razor, the philosophy of cut through it and get to the truth of it. And generally, it is the most direct and honest answers, and that's what we seek. Because progressivism is to seek the truth without having to first monitor with some ideological identity. No, the truth doesn't need an ideological identity. It just needs good spokespersons to bring it to you. And we have that at the Progressive Radio Network. We challenge Big Pharma. We challenge the big industries like Monsanto and DuPont. We challenge Wall Street and the banking community and the energy cartels, nuclear, high gas hydrofracking. We challenge all of them every day, 24/7. This is a place to come. If you can handle the truth. I'm Gary Null. I believe that you want to have as healthy a body as possible. What's the number one cause of death in America? Heart attacks, strokes, heart disease. We can prevent most of these if we do simply three things. If we eat a healthy plant-based diet, reduce our calories to what our body actually needs, exercise regularly, and de-stress by things that can be as simple as listening to calming music or yoga, meditation, prayer. But I want to add my own extra little insurance in there. I created a product based on my years of experience in counseling tens of thousands of individuals as a registered dietitian, as a board-certified clinical nutritionist, as a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, as a professor, adjunct professor of nutrition science, and as a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology for 33 years in anti-aging medicine and publishing in peer-reviewed literature. So I know something about the body and what it needs. And so I created a product called Cardio Stuff. And Cardio Stuff would have to take everything you see right here. Look at this. You have all these different grains and legumes and fruits and all these bottles. Now, most people, you say, what are you doing for your heart? Oh, my doctor told me to take coenzyme Q10. Okay, there's your coenzyme Q10. And you look at, wow, that's expensive. And then you say, oh, but the omega-3 fatty acids. Oh, we got the omega-3 fatty acids over there. Oh, and quercetin. Well, all these things that you see, all these nutrients, and all those are all in this one single scoop that when you take it each day in the morning, with your favorite beverage, let's say it's orange juice, grapefruit juice, grape juice, water, maybe rice milk, it is bursting forth to go to every cell in your body. And this is really, really good for you. It's vegan. It's non-GMO. It's all natural. Cardio Stuff. Now, I have it on special sale for you, so it's not going to break the bank for anyone. And by the way, what better way to spend a few extra dollars than on your health, on something as vital. I believe in vitalism. I believe in being as healthy to yourself as you can be. And I want to be healthy to every cell in my body, every organ in my body. That's why I created Cardio Stuff. Now, there's a number on your screen. Please write down this number. The number is 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Here's what you're going to get when you get your jar of Cardio Stuff. You're going to get organic oatmeal and brown rice bran and oat bran and red wine extract. And get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we got started a little late, a little problem with Skype on my end, I guess. So let's just jump right into it. The topics this week are miscellaneous. What are the main events of this past week that are notable? So let's just jump right into that and talk about those most notable events, in my opinion. First one of interest here is the jobs report that came out last week and the weekly unemployment claims. We have this big big contradiction between the two. We are still running on a monthly average here, weekly unemployment claims, 1 million a week, new claims, unemployment. We got, 18-19 million people on benefits, another 4 to 5 million dropped out of the labor force. You know, that's like 23-24 million people officially here, jobless. And yet late last week we had for March, the Labor Department jobs report that showed 900,000 some new jobs created. Well, those aren't new jobs created. Those are recovered jobs that people got laid off and are coming back into. You know, when you lay off, tens of millions of people and you restore them, it looks like a big jump. But they're not new jobs. New jobs would be jobs created, total jobs created greater than what we had in December 2019. That would be new jobs. These are recovered jobs. Okay, but a big contradiction here. You know, we're running 1 million a week as we have for over a year and maybe even more so a year ago this time. What's going on? You know, why are we still losing 1 million a week? And by the way, you know, the jobs that people are recovering and coming back to, most of them are fewer hours. These are service jobs and leisure, hospitality, retail, you know, and businesses are opening up those jobs, recalling these people very cautiously. And in other words, they're not giving them full 40-hour weeks anymore. They're coming back at fewer hours as business tests the waters here. Do we have a true recovery going, or do we have just a rebound from a reopening? There's a difference between rebounds and recoveries. Rebounds are just reopening the economy. Recovery is sustained. Well, what's it going to be this time in the second half of this year? You know, we went through this already last summer. We had a opening of the economy, a rebound in the third quarter of U.S. economic activity that then dissipated, flattened out in the fourth quarter. In other words, it was not sustained. You know, we lost 10.5% the GDP first half of last year, recovered 7.5% third quarter, and then it flopped in the fourth quarter. Rebound dissipated, faded. That's what rebounds are. They're not sustained recoveries. Well, what is it this time? A repeat of last year? We don't know. We'll see. You know, I'm worried. I'm worried, though, that the stimulus that's being passed is not sufficient, right? Okay, as we've talked before, let me just mention briefly, you know, Biden's American Rescue Plan, the COVID-19 stimulus, allegedly $1.9 trillion announced, you know, several weeks ago, according to the Congressional Budget Office, only $1 trillion of that is authorized this year. And we know hundreds of billions of that is not going to actually be spent. That was authorized $1 trillion, not 1.9, $1 trillion authorized. And we know state and local government's going to sit on a lot of their money, that $350 billion of that $1 trillion, as they did in 2009-10. And we know that some people getting the checks are going to use it to pay down debt, or just to use it as a precautionary fund because they don't know what the future is going to bring. Well, that's not going to get in the economy either. So we're looking at, maybe $800 billion stimulus this year out of a $22 trillion economy. That's not much. That's not sufficient, in my view. Okay, so then we got the infrastructure bill. Well, you're not going to see anything from that this year, maybe next year, beginning. You know, and a lot of that is backloaded, meaning it's an 8-year proposal infrastructure, so it's going to be in the out years you're going to see more of that spending. Well, that's not going to stimulate much right now and make sure the rebound becomes a sustained recovery. You know, I mean, as I said last week, the House isn't even going to take it up until late summer. And then the Senate, what happens there? Well, you know, Joe Manchin, Blue Dog Democrat, West Virginia, said that he won't support a budget resolution to pass the infrastructure bill, which means that 51 votes won't count. You need 60, and he's against the filibuster. You'll need 60. You won't get 60 on the infrastructure bill. That will likely be gutted in half if it gets passed next year. You know, with most of it taking an impact in the out years, not even during Biden's first term. Well, that's no stimulus. Okay, so, I'm really worried that the rebound isn't going to get sufficient momentum behind it with the fiscal spending to really turn it into a sustained recovery. And then that means jobs are going to continue to gush as they are now. And jobs coming back are going to be at lower weekly earnings. That does not portend well for a sustained recovery. But that's what we're looking at here. Okay. And by the way, you know, these job numbers, they're both Labor Department numbers, you know. But there's a difference. The unemployment claims are actual data. Those are actual people making actual claims. It's a kind of a census of claims. The Labor Department monthly is statistics. It's not the actual data. It's some data from multiple sources that are then done statistical operations upon, which gives us a statistic. A statistic is not the raw data. A statistic is data that's been manipulated, you know, through seasonality adjustments or new business formation adjustments, lots of adjustments with lots of assumptions to give you a number that is not a real actual number, but a manipulated number. And there's problems with those statistical manipulations during the COVID crisis, creating an anomaly situation here, for statistical operations that are supposed to work in stable times. So these are not stable times. So the statistics get perverted. And you compare that monthly perverted data from the Labor Department job creation, which is just job restoration, to the actual data of the weekly new unemployment claims over a million a week, every week, still going on. You know, this is a Great Recession 2.0, which means, like the first prior one in 2008-10, it's going to take 7 years, 5 to 7 years, to recover just the level of jobs we lost. Yeah, just to recover what we had 2019 levels. You know, in the first Great Recession, it took us, 7 years to get back to 2007 levels of jobs. And then it came back with lower wages. Well, we're going to lower wages again. We're seeing it happening. Oh, but we will see inflation, you know, but not because of the stimulus, which is so minuscule right now, not because of that. Although that's what the Republicans and conservatives are trying to say. Oh, we can't spend this money because it'll cause inflation. No, it's too small. Too small. You know, you're talking about $800 billion out of $22 trillion economy. That's not going to stimulate inflation. Ah, but you will see inflation. Well, wait a minute. How? Because business is going to test the markets and raise prices here over the summer to make up for the lack of being able to do so last year, and actually prices falling, deflation last year in many of these sectors of the economy, deflation. So they're going to try to recoup those lost prices. Oh, but, you know, you're starting from the lower deflated level, so it looks like you got inflation. Well, we're not even getting back probably to the price levels that existed in 2019. How can that be inflation? I mean, if it were higher than 2019, but when you compare, let's say, March to March or April to April, April this year to April last year, well, prices collapsed April, March, April, May last year. So you're getting an inflation on top of a collapsed price. It's not prices rising higher than December of 2019. It's prices rising from a trough of March, April, May of 2020. Well, that's not inflation. No, but they'll spend it that way. Okay, so that's my comment on jobs and inflation today. And the fact that we are in a Great Recession 2.0, and whether or not this is, as they open, a rebound or a recovery. All right, another interesting development here last week was Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen came out and said, we need to raise corporate taxes globally. Now, one of the proposals being floated by Biden is to do something about this big tax ripoff that multinational corporations have been engaging in for some time now. What they do is change their internal transfer prices to book their profits in their offshore subsidiaries. That way they pay less on profits here in the U.S. Activity. They shield their profits from their offshore operations from the U.S. government. How do they shield it? Well, you know, go back to the 1990s. Our good buddy Bill Clinton instituted a tax change in which U.S. multinational corporations could simply check a box on their tax returns that would suspend taxation on their foreign operations. Yeah, it was even called the check the box loophole. Yeah, that's what they did. And they got away without paying 35% corporate rate on their offshore activities. And then they manipulate their internal pricing so they book their profits offshore rather than in the U.S. They don't pay taxes on it. Yeah. Well, you know, when Trump came in office, you know, by the way, he had promised $5.5 trillion in tax cuts when he was running for office. He delivered $4.5 trillion, not bad. You know, but 85% of that went to the wealthiest 1% in their corporations. Of that $4.5 trillion passed in January 2018, 85% went to the 1%. I mean, it was a big boondoggle. Lowered the corporate rate from 35 to 21%. Yeah. Lowered the non-corporate tax rate to 20% and allowed non-corporate businesses to deduct every cost virtually that they had from their taxes, so they don't even pay that. Yeah. And by the way, you know, big law firms and real estate trusts and so forth, they're not considered corporations, and they got a big write-off, right? Deduct anything and everything. Virtually nothing, nothing. Well, part of the multinational tax cut under Trump was to reduce the corporate tax rate from 35% to 10.5%. I mean, they often didn't even pay that, but 10.5%. And then that was called the GILTI tax. That's an acronym, G-I-L-T-I, GILTI, right? 10.5%. Oh, but they could deduct what they paid foreign government taxes from that 10.5%. And they could figure it out on a global basis, kind of, you know, not a country by country basis, but globally. That allowed them even greater deductions. So, you know, U.S. multinational corporations under Trump paid virtually nothing. Nothing. Yeah, trillions and trillions of dollars. You know, before the crisis here and that tax cut, U.S. corporations admitted that they had stuffed $7 trillion in their offshore subsidiaries. $7 trillion. Yeah. And they're all kind of loopholes, like inversions, tax inversions. You know, U.S. companies locate their nominal headquarters abroad, usually in Ireland or Bermuda or Luxembourg or even Netherlands, right? And they pretty much avoid paying any taxes. And U.S. multinational corporations paid maybe 2%, 2.5% to U.S. government on their foreign operations, $7 trillion sitting offshore there. And that was Trump. And by the way, you know, if you look at over 10 years, that amounted to about $200 billion a year, $2 trillion. $2 trillion. Oh, but Trump didn't calculate that when he said, oh, the cost of the tax cut. No, they ignored that $2 trillion and, you know, all those measures I just mentioned. Guilty tax. Mm-hmm. They and that's how they got it down in part to $1.5 trillion. They said, oh, the Trump tax cut only cost $1.5 trillion. No, it cost over $4 trillion. And they didn't count the $2 trillion in offshore tax cuts for multinational corporations. Also, they figured, oh, you know, they estimated this tax cut is going to bring in a lot of revenue because it's really going to boost investment and U.S. business growth, GDP. You know, we're going to have 3.5% GDP growth for the next 10 years and no recessions. Well, the recession hit like hell, didn't it? Yeah, that helped. There goes the tax revenues. And business investment actually declined in 2019 as a result of the Trump tax cuts. Declined in the U.S. Didn't stimulate investment and therefore hiring of jobs. No, just the opposite. It declined. So what did they do with that money, corporations? Oh, a lot of it they just pumped right back into the stock market. $1 trillion a year, and under Trump, $1.3 trillion a year, every year, for 3 years, went to their shareholders. Yeah, they gave the shareholders in dividends and stock buybacks $1.3 trillion. That was just the Fortune 500 companies I'm talking about. $1.3 trillion every year to the shareholders. You know, in tech companies, that's mostly the officers. Now, they're mostly the owners of tech companies. So this massive income redistribution was the consequence of the Trump tax cut. Massive. You know, unheard of. By the way, it was almost $1 trillion every year for the 8 years under Obama, too. So Trump just accelerated the whole thing. You know, they've given like $15 trillion to their shareholders since the Great Recession in 2009. $15 trillion went to shareholders, dividends, payouts, and stock buybacks. That's data. That's obvious. You know, that's fact. That's there. Then you wonder why we have such income inequality accelerating in this country. And meanwhile, people got the jobs back, on average, earned less since 2009. No wonder we got income inequality runaway, you know, and no increase in the minimum wage, et cetera. So, you know, it's all a game to redistribute income to the rich through the fiscal policy. Well, you know, Biden has proposed to take some of that back. You know, the corporate tax rate under Trump was reduced from 35 to 21%. So he's going to raise it back to 28%. Right. And this guilty tax on multinational corporations where they virtually paid nothing, you know, nominally 10.5% instead of 35, but nothing in effect. Well, he's proposing to raise that back from 10.5% to 21% and then eventually 26% over 15 years. You know, the Biden tax hike is a 15-year policy. Come on, you know, you don't think that's going to really happen over 15 years. The stimulus is an 8, 8, and his infrastructure bill is an 8-year program. But the tax cuts, which are backloaded again, in other words, we're not going to hit the corporations too hard here initially during his first term. You know, so it's lopsided. They backload this stuff. And that's why Larry Summers liked it. Oh, this is great. I like the infrastructure bill. It's backloaded. Okay, taxation was backloaded. Except in New York, you know, Larry Summers, the shill for corporate America and the bankers, academic shill, came out here this past week complaining about New York raising, state of New York, New York City, raising taxes on corporations and the millionaires. Said, oh, they're going to leave. Right? Can't raise taxes on our millionaires, poor millionaires, right? Yeah. But he did like the fact that even though New York State's going to raise the tax rate, they're going to leave the loopholes, the deductibles, see? Oh, that's good, Larry says. But though, I shouldn't raise the rate on these poor people. Yeah. A shill. You know, so many economists play that game. You know, oh, but they get paid well, you see. They get invited to sit on corporate boards. Yeah, they become board members, you know, who make $50,000 every time they attend the meeting. Yeah, they get paid $50,000 for one or two meetings a year for corporations, you know. And there are 5 or 6 of these corporations. Well, that's a nice, pretty penny there every year, $300,000-$500,000. Yeah. So, but you know, Larry, you got to write stuff. You know, Larry, who's a regular for Bloomberg News, you know, you got to write stuff to confuse people as to the effects of tax increases and infrastructure spending and COVID relief and so forth. And that's Larry's role. Larry's an economic prostitute. And there's a lot of them out there. Yeah. Justify. And that's what the media picks up, the liberal media, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and they peddle around, you know, like this peddling around. Oh, we're down 8 million jobs. Right? You've heard that one. 8 million jobs. Well, how the hell can we be down 8 million jobs when we got 19 million people on unemployment benefits? Come on. And both of those are Labor Department data, but they cherry pick. They cherry pick the data they like, and they push it out there to us. Okay, so Janet Yellen here, Treasury Secretary, has announced they're going to try to get negotiations with the 20 most advanced economies, you know, Europe, North America, North Asia here, to agree on a corporate tax so that companies don't manipulate running their headquarters from one to the other. You know, if the U.S. raises corporate tax rate, they just run to Ireland or somewhere, right, to get under the lower umbrella there. Well, you know, this is the race to the bottom. Corporations have been, especially multinational, have been very clever at moving around and taking advantage of the lowest tax countries, putting their nominal headquarters in them in order to get the lower rates and play the games, you know, guilty tax games and so forth, right? So Yellen has tried to, she's announced, you know, and she wouldn't have announced if there wasn't some sort of new momentum there. Because, you know, for multinational corporations, if Biden lowers the rate even to raises the rate to even 28%. What's the stop? You know, Coca-Cola and Boeing and these companies from simply moving their headquarters to a lower tax. That's called inversions. You see, that's a big loophole. The inversions loophole. Move your headquarters and claim your taxes in this nominal headquarters that's not in the U.S. anymore. Yellen is in U.S. Treasury. If they want Biden's corporate tax hike to have an effect, they're going to have to prevent this race to the bottom, global race to the bottom the corporations are taking advantage of. Within the U.S., there is a race to the bottom on state-to-state taxation. This has been going on at the same time. You know, some states have corporate taxes and income taxes, and some states don't. And there's other corporate taxes of various kinds, you know. So, you know, U.S. corporations move their headquarters from one state to the other state to avoid taxes. And then when they lose that tax revenue, you know, the states that had lost it, they offer more concessions. Oh, come back, you know, we'll cut your taxes even more. So, you know, all the states are engaging in this race to the bottom here. Well, that's been going on globally with corporate taxation as well. You know, corporate taxation in this country used to be in the 60s, 20%, I think it was, of total government revenue. What is it now? Five or less of total revenue. They've been very successful in that. Well, we'll see what this new initiative is. It's going to be kind of difficult, I think, though, to get 20 different countries agreeing to the same corporate tax, you know, and who's going to get the revenue, how much is each going to get. That's a big issue, especially since all these governments are starved for revenue here in the pandemic. What about the pandemic? You know, COVID, is it gone away? Well, we got this big race to vaccine people, but in the U.S. But there's a problem here, you know, looming on the horizon, and that's the COVID variants. We really don't know how that's going to continue to hit the economy. You know, we got this U.K. variant, now the dominant variant in the U.S., you know, more infectious and just as more deadly, I guess, at the same time. Ah, but we have other new, even more deadly variants popping up. You know, in California now we got this India variant, which is, I think, an offshoot from the Brazilian. We don't know how dangerous that really is. You know, Europe itself is undergoing this fourth wave of infections, which is wrecking their economy once again, ensuring that they will not engage in the recovery that the U.S. and China are experiencing, at least initially here in terms of the rebound, reopening. What's going to happen with this India variant? And then Canada, we got this raging Brazilian variant up in Canada that they're trying to get their hands on. So, you know, this COVID pestilence here is, you know, it's a bad bug. It's a hard bug to get rid of, you know, and we're racing with the in vaccines with to some effect here in the U.S., but that's we don't know how it will really yet affect the variants. You know, we're seeing some evidence of the variants making younger people, middle-aged people, not middle-aged, but you know, people under 40 sick, like the early variants did not. It hit mostly the elderly people. So, you know, keep your eye on that. What's the economic effect of that? And we're not out of that woods yet, I don't think. And what about, you know, the financial side? I've been watching that very closely, financial fragility in the economy, global, because it's a global financial system, certainly. Now, what's going on? What's going on here? Well, you know, I'm a little bit worried from what I see here. Look over in Europe, Credit Suisse Bank, big Credit Suisse Bank, right? Speculating in these very risky companies that are going under. There's a Greensill Bank in the UK, I think it was, went under. Going to cost, you know, tens of billions of dollars of losses for Credit Suisse. And I know in the wake of that, we have the Archegos, whatever how you pronounce it, speculator. That went under. Credit Suisse was, you know, lending them money. Credit Suisse, you know, is going to take like 30, 40 billion in losses, I think, here. And how much of that is going to reverberate on other financial institutions that Credit Suisse is associated with? You know, it's like a spider's web. Everybody, you know, in the financial system is lending to everybody else, you know, and multiple chains of lending here ties all these financial institutions together. So a big loss in one causes a, you know, heartburn in another one, then it can spread. That's why you see contagion You could have one or two big companies or banks that go under that sets off this contagion effect across the board. And we still haven't felt the impact from the last year impact on certain sectors and companies in these very hard hit sectors like leisure and hospitality in the U.S. You know, hotels are going under here, certainly, and especially those in the inner cities are not going to really reopen. Some of the smaller hotels, a lot of junk bonds have been loaned to hotels and entertainment companies like movie chains and parks, theme parks, transport companies. When I say junk, in other words, loans have been made to these companies to get them through COVID here at very high interest rates, relative rates, that's junk rates. And how are they going to pay for this now is the question. You know, how well can they... the danger period is ahead for those companies that have taken on a lot of bad debt. Usually they're companies that had been taking on bad debt for quite some time, and now we're taking on even more bad debt, but they're going to have to pay for that. In other words, they're going to have to service it, pay the principal and interest, and if they can't, then they default. And if they default, then whoever loaned them the money has to take a loss on their books. And who knows how that reverberates, you know, to other financial institutions. You know, it's very opaque. We don't know what goes on all the times in these financial institutions. It's not very clear. You know, well, I mean, take even stock trades. You know, almost half of all the stock trades occur in what's called dark pools. In other words, they're not public. You know, it's not on the exchanges. You don't see it. Mm. Yeah, well, how much of the is opaque with derivatives trading? We don't know. You know, I mean, the financial system is kept away, you know, the machinations and functioning is kept shielded away, even from regulators, even from politicians. They don't know what's really going on. You know, they don't want you to know what's going on because a lot of deals are being made and a lot of fortunes are being made by investors, you know, big boys. You know, and then we got these practices coming that are really questionable. You know, SPACs, S-P-A-C, acronym, special purchase vehicles, where people are investing their money in a SPAC, which doesn't even have money in it, companies in it yet. Yeah, not even in it yet. They're throwing their money into this hole that they hope will turn profitable. Well, when you got so much liquid capital, money capital to throw around as the rich do, you know, let's throw some money in here. You know, it's a long shot, but could you know, strike gold and return big for us here. So let's throw some money in this or that SPAC. And then we have what's called now blank check ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Again, very similar, right? Just write a check, throw it into the ETF, you know, and you don't know who the hell they're actually, what companies are going to populate that ETF, which is a kind of a security, you know, exchange-traded funds that you can buy and sell, you know, in financial markets and stock markets and so forth, where people just invest in this aggregator of stocks or this aggregator of bonds. And let that follow the market, you see, not individual company investments, but in these collectives, you know, called ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Well, blank check now, you know, ETFs are being created and investors are just given a blank check, right? And that's really hot now, just like SPACs. In other words, all this stuff, you know, whether you're looking at Greensill Bank, Archegos, you know, Credit Suisse, or SPACs or blank check ETFs or whatever, you know, it's all evidence of this speculation, risk, high risk taking going on, which always ends up in a bubble that bursts at some point. You know, and watch out for hotels and parks and movie chains being taking on a lot of debt they can't pay for. And watch a little longer term office buildings. Yeah. Businesses are fleeing the big urban centers because of the COVID thing, and they don't know whether it's going to, well, there's going to be another one, even when this one's over. You know, it's going to happen. There's too much cross, you know, through the transport system, people traveling everywhere and anywhere across the globe now. We're too integrated. Too many people from, you know, places like Wuhan or whatever, traveling and therefore spreading this thing so darn fast you can't get your hands on it. You know, you can't even track and trace this stuff. These waves come so fast now. And this is a feature that's going to be with us. You know, today it's COVID-19. Who knows what it's going to be tomorrow and how soon tomorrow will come. I think the 21st century globalist capitalist economy is going to have to live with these infections and its impact on the economy. You know, unless you want to dismantle the global financial system and transport system, which isn't going to happen, right? It's going to become a permanent, more or less, feature of it. So, you know, there's going to have to be massive fiscal stimulus ongoing. And they're not really spending enough. Not really spending enough, I don't think. We got a problem here. Okay, the last topic I want to talk about is Amazon. Amazon had this union vote here to unionize its Bessemer, Alabama facility, 5,800 workers in that facility. And it's results of that mail-in voting have now been concluded. And out of the 5,800, I think something like 3,400 actually voted. Not all of them voted. About 1,800 voted against the union, and about 800 for the union. About 500 challenged ballots, which aren't enough to change the results. So, you know, what we've got here is a defeat in the South, another one for organized labor unions trying to unionize the South, just like the auto workers, just like the machinists with Boeing. You know, they haven't been able to organize the South. Culture there is not conducive to unionization. And, of course, this whole voting, this government voting with the National Labor Relations Board gives a tremendous advantage to businesses, to management side. You know, it was originally developed, NLRB, under the 1935 National Labor Relations Act called the Wagner Act, which was designed with all the strikes going on during the 1930s. Workers were striking for recognition, just withholding their labor, saying, recognize our union management, or we're not going back to work. Well, there were a lot of strikes. And the whole NRA and NRB thing was designed to bring that whole process under control and eliminate the need to strike for recognition of the union, and to do it through a government managed voting, you know, secret ballot voting. The workers simply on the day of the election get a ballot. They don't have to sign for it, and they mark an X in the box either for the union or a box, you know, no union. And they put it in a, you know, in a NRB government regulated ballot box controlled by the government, and then they count the votes. So no one signs, you don't see, whatever. But there's tremendous advantage to the employer, because the employer can say, you know, hey, you know, if you guys don't vote, we're going to raise prices, your wages anyway. So what are you voting for? Why pay for dues, union dues, you know? You'll pay more union dues than you get wage increase. And we'll give you a wage increase anyway. You know, you don't have to do that. Well, saying we'll give you a wage increase anyway is illegal in elections. But there's ways of doing it that the word gets out, you know. And the problem is management has a direct line, you know, 8 hours a day to these folks through their supervisors and everybody. And they're sympathizers, you know. One of the tactics is always to set up a pro-management committee of the workers to tell the other workers who may want a union, you know, oh, terrible things are going to happen. They're going to move the warehouse of the factory if you vote union. Oh, terrible things are going to happen. But good things will happen if you don't vote for the union. You see, management can't say these things that call them for labor practice, but this committee of workers, pro-sympathizers, usually led by people bucking to be a foreman or supervisor, you know, they can say, they can lie and misrepresent all they want, you know, and they do. And they are given the arguments to be made by professional law firms that are brought in by the employer to engineer this strategy to defeat the union vote, right? These are, you know, high-powered union law firms, anti-union law firms, that are paid big bucks by the companies to manage the anti-union campaign. And they provide all the ammunition to these pro-management committees of workers, you see. And they, you know, the themes that will work and how to say things without getting, you know, in caught in a bald-faced lie, and they're given resources here, time off by the company, right? And the company will even have meetings. Everyone gets to stop work and come to the meeting where, you know, the leaders of the anti-union worker committee here get to speak, and management maybe speaks, and maybe the lawyer speaks, you know. These are captured meetings. How does the union get people to come to a meeting? Well, it's got to be off-site, you see. The union doesn't get an on-site meeting. And the management can have as many meetings as they want, as frequently as they want. It's hard to get union for the union to get meetings off-site, especially when the anti-union people, worker committee and, you know, pro-management worker committee shows up and starts taking writing down names of everyone else who shows up at the union meeting, you see? Intimidation. And then management shows, elections over here, and, you know, what happened? Well, the company shut down and moved, you know? Oh, we're not saying we're going to do that, but we're saying, oh, this happens a lot, you know? There's all kind of ways of suggesting and inferring without saying, you see? And they intimidate. They scare the hell out of everybody, carrot and stick, scare them that they may lose their job, right? And, of course, we know how important it is to hold on to a job nowadays. Job security isn't that great. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they offer them a carrot, you know. We were going to give you guys a raise, you know. And, here's a letter that was written internally. You haven't seen it yet 2 months ago that says give everyone a 5% raise. Oh, well, wait a minute. Isn't that illegal, under the government, the rules for elections? Not if they can produce something in writing before the union filed that said, oh, a raise was imminent. It was coming. Or, oh, we were going to include dependent benefits or whatever. You know, all you got to do is back write some sort of letter like this in management and throw that up, and they got a cover for themselves. You see? Well, how do I know all this stuff, all this tactics and so forth? Well, because I was a union organizer for 15 years. I saw all this, how this was done. It became a real science here by management in the 1980s. One of the reasons why in the 80s I sort of said, oh, the hell with this, you know? But in the 70s, it wasn't so bad yet. And I was quite successful, won 80% of my NLRB elections, you know. But people were much more militant in the 70s. You know, they didn't fall for all this crap. You know, in the 80s, we got a new generation of workers who were more pro-management, it seemed, or more desperate to hold on to their jobs. And, you know, these anti-union law firms had firmed up their whole strategy. It became a real science. So the company using these anti-union law firms and the tried and proven strategy for defeating a union vote and all the resources and the ability to have immediate meetings and to get around promising things if they didn't vote, you know, all that become an art in the 80s and 90s. And it still is. Still is. Big advantage. Disadvantage to the union, big advantage to the company using these NRB elections now. Very hard to break through that. It's part of what I call the legal web that's been, wound around unions and the labor movement here in this country. They're like Gulliver, you know, who's pinned down by all this web, you know, legal web here, and they can't move. And as a result, you know, union membership, which was over 20% back in the early 80s, is now 10%. And 10-11%, and 5% or less in the private sector. You know, most of that 11% is public workers, public employees, who aren't part of the NLRB game, you know, this election game in the private sector. They aren't part of that. And, of course, the public sector can't play these games because these people are voted, you know, voted in by, you know, politicians, both state and local politicians are voted. So public employee unions are much more powerful, and their governments don't play these games to destroy unions or prevent unions or throw out unions. But in the private sector, they do play these games very effectively. Very effectively, they play these games. And that's what we saw here at Amazon. The union will contest the vote. They will say, oh, management did all these illegal things. There will be a hearing. It will take a year to hear all the complaints and everything. During that year, Amazon management in Alabama will be very careful. They'll give those raises that they promised, you know. And it will dissipate, you know. Until labor finds another way of getting around this NLRB election game, which initially, as I said, in the 1930s was developed to bring stability to the unionization vote. Instead of striking for unionization, have these elections. At first, you know, it was kind of fair. But this whole apparatus, this law firm apparatus has been built up. The strategy has been built up. The rules have been weakened. They can get away with threatening. They can get away with promising more easily than before. And even if the union had won at Alabama, it would not be the beginning. Management would contest it. They would challenge it, you know, and it would take a year or more for the challenges to occur and be heard and so forth. And during that year, you know, the workers wouldn't get any wage increases because, you know, that would be by the rules not possible while this thing was pending. You know, the review was pending, and they would use that as an excuse to say, see what the union did to you. Yeah, we can't give you any raises because, you know, the union says no, but we could have, you know, if you voted no. This is the game they play, and it's very effective, and it's why the private sector unionization is part of the reason why it's so low here historically, never been lower. Even though 65% of the people in the country interviewed said they would want a union, only 5% are able to have one in the private sector. That's the reality. Part of the reason union membership is so low as well is because a lot of the unionized jobs, particularly in manufacturing, have been sent offshore. You know, we had in 2000, we had 18.5 million people in manufacturing. Where we got 12 million now, about 6 million. Well, before the pandemic, we got even less than that. Where do 6 million jobs go? Well, free trade got rid of a bunch of them, and automation, in other words, tax incentives for corporations to displace jobs with new equipment, right? Tax incentives to do that. Tax incentives to send the jobs offshore. yeah, workers vote for these Republicans and some Democrats, you know, who then turn around and vote to send their jobs offshore. And then, of course, you can get a low-paid service job if you want somewhere, you know, working at a theme park or in a hotel or, you know, in a retail sector and so forth. And then COVID comes and wipes those jobs out. And around the corner, another massive storm coming, and that's artificial intelligence, which is going to destroy 30% of all the occupations this decade, according to McKinsey consultants. So, you know, the working class is getting whacked ever since Reagan in a number of different directions, getting whacked. You know, it's like running a gauntlet, you know, and on both sides they got clubs and they're whacking you as you're running through this gauntlet. You know, maybe you get through, but you're a bloody mess by the time you do. Right. Well, that's the working class in this country. Right. Good jobs taken away. Lousy jobs. Gig jobs, got to have two or three of them, wage compression, no minimum wage increase, right? Pensions privatized, health care, you know, your cost sharing goes up. You can hardly afford health care anymore. Your kids get to college, but they're indentured in debt for the rest of their lives if they're lucky to get that far. You know, this is the reality. This is the reality, wage compression. You know, no real wage increases. You know, adjusted for inflation since 1983 in this country. It's been stagnant after inflation. Oh, but the wealthy 1%, you know, they get $1 trillion a year in dividend payouts and stock buybacks, and that's just the Fortune 500 companies. You know, what about the other 5,000 corporations? They don't give us numbers for them. No. So, you know, that's the reality that's faced. It's a terrible reality, and it's not... you know, it's not improving, really. You know, we are in the midst of the second great recession here. As I said before, these jobs aren't coming back, and those that do come back are often going to be less paid, fewer benefits, right? And the Biden administration's trying to fill that collapsing consumption hole here. You know, to some extent, consumption has grown not due to wage increases in wage income, but because of credit. And of course, people are indebted up to their eyes and elbows now. So Biden's trying to throw some money into that big hole, that big black hole. But it's not going to be enough, I don't think. Not going to be enough. And at the same time, you know, when they try to pay for throwing something into the big hole to save tens of millions of people, you know, corporations, oh, we can't afford to pay, you know, after the tax cuts have been slashed again and again and again. We've given $15 trillion in tax cuts, 85% of which have gone to the wealthy 1% and corporations and investors since 2001. $15 trillion documented. It's a fact. You know, so we're going to take back a little of that over 15 years, according to Biden. Oh, but Larry Summers says too much. Don't do it. You know? I mean, no wonder people are pissed off. You know? And this is the last shot that the Democrats have. They got 18 months, maybe, to do something. Their last shot. Oh, but it's not going to be easy. You know, with Blue Dog Mansion and Cinema out there, they're going to do everything. They're Republicans, corporate shills, and, quote, Democratic clothing. Okay, well, that's it for today here. Next week we'll see what the future brings, okay? Walk the streets as free.